Hey, everybody. Welcome to V Speaks, Conversations with Heart and Soul. I'm Lisa Burwell, your host, and I am also the founder and editor-in-chief of V Magazine, now in its 17th year. So our podcast is to continue our storytelling ethos, but in a different format, the podcast. And today I am thrilled to bring Stephanie Harlow, a true crime podcaster, a documentarian. And she has a couple of different podcasts that she helms and co-hosts as well. Stephanie, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome. Well, I love your name, Stephanie Harlow. It sounds very old-fashioned
old
movie
Hollywood,
star, right?
Yeah.
Oh, Hollywood. I absolutely love it. Like, that's just perfect. And I've watched several of your podcasts, and I really love how your, let's call it your look, your brand, when you've got your glasses on. Super smart, you know, delving down into the investigative reporting, and you're very interesting. You're very telegenic to watch. Incredible.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And I find that the genre of, you know, true crime and true crime reporting and podcasting is like probably right up there with like number one or two genres that the world likes to devour. When you got into podcasting, background in psychology and journalism as well, and just with what I would have to say is a ferocious appetite for truth and truth finding and information, like specifically in the world of crime. In your background, did you ever want to be in the police department? Did you ever want to be an investigator? Because you seem so much like attached to that, that they must either be talking to you or you're talking to them. Talk about that.
No, I think at my heart, I am a storyteller. I love to tell, like, everyone has a story and it's all going to be interesting. Everyone's story is interesting, viewed through the right lens and the right perspective. And then their parents have an interesting story, and then their parents' parents have an interesting story. And it all sort of genetically and generationally dribbles down into everyone. And I just find that very interesting. And, you know, I love the old, like, Anne Rice, you know, the way that she did not just the vampire stories, but the witch stories, the witching hour, and how she brought, she built this entire legacy of powerful women and how it's passed down. And there's this place in New Orleans and this house, and a lot of families have that. We just don't know about it. So I find that all the stories are interesting. So even in a true crime case, what's affecting the true crime case, the people involved? The families of the people involved, even the place where it happens is important to not only why it happened in the context, but to building the story around it. And why do we have to make true crime cases interesting stories? Because they're real. They happen to real people. And unfortunately, in today's world, in order to get a broad mass of people to care about somebody they've never met, you have to make the story interesting. And you have to make them care about the person. And how do you make them care about the person? Well, you have to tell them about that person, not just how they died, how they lived. As a child, what was their favorite stuffed animal? And this is why I work with the families of victims a lot. Tell me about your daughter who was, you know, kidnapped and murdered. What did she like to do when she was in high school? What was her yearbook superlative? When you were home alone with her on the weekends, what did you do together? What movies did you watch? What makes a person three-dimensional? All these little things that only the people closest to them know. And so I want to build that out to make everybody feel like these victims could be your sister, your mother, your brother, your husband, your child. And then they care.
Well, that shows that you're giving like immense respect to the person who's fallen, who's not here anymore. And then for the living family members, friends, relatives, and loved ones, there's immense respect for that person who's no longer here. How did you fall into or dive into this genre? Like, what was it about you that wanted to do, to storytell in this manner?
I like history. So I remember reading history stories about people, and I was like, this is crazy. Nobody knew about this little sort of side person in history, but they had this incredible story to tell. And so when I was much younger, I thought about, and before podcasting even existed, I'm 41, so there was a time where I lived where podcasts did not exist. And I would want to share stories with people in person. So I'd read something and then I'd be at a family gathering and I would almost like a campfire thing. Mm-hmm. You know, they'd be like, what are you learning about today, Stephanie? And I'd be like, oh, let me tell you. And mm-hmm. I'd regale them with these tales. And luckily I had a great family mm-hmm. who gave me that outlet where a lot of kids, you know, their parents would be like, hey, we don't want to hear about this. Like, right. shut
you
up,
had a
go
good
get
audience
me a beer. Yeah.
In your family.
I had yep. a captive audience and right. they were full of, you know, admiration and they enjoyed the stories. Yeah. And it felt like such a connecting experience mm-hmm. to share something that you were passionate about that you had learned mm-hmm. and I also learned well that way to repeat what I've learned to mm-hmm. others and mm-hmm. then it cements in my mind so I would do that and then they'd be interested and mm-hmm. and it was this connecting familial experience mm-hmm. of being together and sharing a story and sharing a passion for something and then when YouTube came around mm-hmm. I was like, well, I can do this on a bigger scale. Mm-hmm. This is like, I have goosebumps mm-hmm. right now thinking about how exciting it was when mm-hmm. I was like, I can share this and I can find my people because I'm weird. I'm a weird person. In true crime, yeah. before oh. podcasts yeah. and YouTube, you didn't go out in the yeah. in the wild and mm-hmm. just walk up to somebody and be like, hey, let's talk about true crime. They'd be like, what's wrong with this girl? Mm-hmm. I go on YouTube and I'm like, there's people, other people like me that mm-hmm. are interested in this. Mm-hmm. And nobody's making them feel weird about it. So mm-hmm. these are my people. I can find my community. I can build a community around me. And it's mm-hmm. exactly what I've done. Mm-hmm. And I love them. I'm seeing them out in the streets, people who have followed my yes. channel. And they're coming out and they're crying. And they're mm-hmm. like, oh, you've moved me. And, yeah. you know, you've been with me for so long. And I listen to you when I'm in the shower. I listen to you mm-hmm. when I'm in the hospital delivering my child. And it's such like, to me, that I start crying. It's right. this moving experience. Right. We could never have met in real life, but yeah. we've touched each other. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What year was that? When did you go on your first podcast?
When did I start on YouTube? My oldest daughter, who's 8 uh-huh. right now, was probably about 3 months old.
Okay.
So it's been wow. probably about 8 years. Wow. Yeah.
Okay.
And I was home mm-hmm. on maternity leave mm-hmm. and I hated my job. Mm-hmm. I was in sales mm-hmm. and I don't have the soul for sales. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, let me see if I can do something. And I had tried a bunch of different things. I just didn't want to go back to work. I don't want to work for anybody. I want to, you mm-hmm. know, be home reading. Mm-hmm. And I tried a bunch of things and then I tried the YouTube thing and it didn't take off right away, but I enjoyed it. And even if I had just 10 people for a little yeah. while, it was 10 people that I would make content for every single right. week and be happy to do so. Right. And then I think it was the Madeline McCann video. There was I did two okay. or three parts on Madeline McCann.
The first one? Like that was your first podcast?
It wasn't the first one, but it was
at the beginning.
You know, a few months okay. after I'd started oh, and that was a big hit one. The algorithm. Yeah. And then wow. And then from there, it just kind of built. Mm-hmm. I was lucky in that way. I didn't have mm-hmm. to wait years and years. Mm-hmm.
How much connection with either law enforcement or detectives or the family did you touch with that one?
McCann? Oh, nothing with that one because nothing. I was unknown.
Okay.
Now I have the credentials. Yeah. I have, hey, I'm not just some random person who's not going to do your story justice. You right. can look and see what I've done. You can look right. and see the way I speak about people. Mm-hmm. It speaks for itself, so I don't have to convince because a lot of these family mm-hmm. members have been taken advantage mm-hmm, of, mm-hmm. or even networks and things, you mm-hmm. know, big networks. And so they're obviously, I would be too, they're a little shy about opening up and being vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And so they want to make sure that they're working with the mm-hmm. right person. Mm-hmm. And so I actually, in 2020, started a podcast with a retired police detective named Derek Levasseur. It's called Crime Weekly. Mm-hmm. Derek also won Big Brother mm-hmm. a few years back. He mm-hmm. was just on Traitors.
Mm-hmm. I saw a couple of episodes of that.
Yeah. So he was big in the reality TV space, but also the law enforcement space because yeah. he was on Breaking Homicide. And then the right. pandemic happened. That got shut down. Right. So we were both looking.
Yeah.
And I mean, now we're best friends. We've known each other forever. We're
and
best
that took
friends.
Off. Like you've got like a couple million off, yeah. followers on that, right?
No, maybe a couple hundred thousand. Oh, okay. I have almost 1 million on my YouTube, but it okay. took off. We get a lot of listens, audio, and we have the video platform right. too. And so through Derek, then I was able to be introduced to other law enforcement professionals. And then through CrimeCon, which is the convention that we go to every year, I meet a ton of people, Nancy Grace and Keith Morrison. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you have right. connections through there. And but as far as the families, I reach out usually mm-hmm. through Facebook. Mm-hmm. I find them on Facebook and then I'm like, hey, this is who I am. Here's my link. This is what I want to do. Right. I would love to tell the story of your child in mm-hmm. the most respectful way possible and try to raise mm-hmm. some awareness. Mm-hmm. For instance, a few months ago, idea of time. Maybe it wasn't a few months ago, but there was a young man in Galesburg, Illinois, and he was there for his last army weekend, and then he was going to become a police officer, I believe, in Texas. And then he ended up dead in some cistern and in only a few inches of water. And I spoke with his mother. His name's Tyler. And I spoke with his mother, and she said, "We think there's foul play here. The police have been very uncooperative." And she sent me everything, police reports, obituary, not obituaries,
death certificates,
death, medical examiner reports, videos that she recorded of the of talking to the police. And I created a series of videos basically around that, where, hey, maybe this wasn't foul play, but the fact that you dropped the ball so poorly in the first 24 to 48 hours of this investigation means we'll never know. And so, like, as a law enforcement body, do better. So I'm big on, like, you know, holding law enforcement accountable, holding criminals accountable as well, and understanding that the justice system is so severely broken in this country, and it needs to be reformed. It needs to honestly be completely started from scratch, because it doesn't make sense. You have child rapists getting out on bail within no time, right? You have rapists in general who, just because your victim didn't die, you get to walk out after 2 years. You tried to kill her. You choked her. You threw her down a mountain. You hoped she died. But just because she survived, you get less time. Make that make sense. That infuriates me. The fact that you attempted to murder this person, and had you had your way, she would have been dead. But just because she was strong and she fought, you get less of a sentence.
Does the justice system as it is right now share your opinion of that, or are you fighting, like, upstream on that, where they just want to keep things status quo? So do you always feel like you're in a big fight against, like, a tidal wave?
You are always in a big fight against a tidal wave when you're trying to change the status quo. And I don't think anybody thinks that the justice system works. I just think that they understand it's too hard
To overhaul
it, to change it. And you're going to have pushback. And we're such a politically divided country in general, where even if everybody agreed on something, they couldn't agree on it, because then they'd be agreeing with the people that they've decided to make their mortal enemies. So if we cannot come together as a collective and agree once and for all, like, hey, violent criminals should be behind bars. And the people who are law-abiding citizens, and, you know, things like drug crime, stuff like that, it's like, I don't care. But when you're actively out there raping women and trying to murder them, and then after 4 years you're walking back out to be allowed to do it again, judges have no accountability. Judges need to have more accountability. Judges have immunity, where it doesn't matter how many bad calls they make, they can never be held responsible in any way. That needs to go. In my opinion, there's a lot that needs to change. But once again, the people in power.
Was there ever a subject matter that you had tackled where you said, wow, this is just getting to me, this is just too much, and you walked away from it? Or even if you stayed the course, was it something that was very difficult for you to go through? Like, either, like, being very pained about, like, something that really horrible happened. I mean, you've got to be strong to not be affected by consuming and trying to write this much.
No, I'm affected. It's just about like anything else, processing it, you know, as it happens. And, and but Chris Watts is a case that always stays with me. What he did to his pregnant wife, what he did to his two daughters. I have their Bella and Cece. I have their birthdays programmed into my phone so that I can think of them. But I think about them all the time. It's it's actually kind of like a tragic how often I think about them. And then there's an issue, because I have three kids of my own, and then so there's an issue of going and reading these stories and getting very deep in, and, oh, you know, they liked that this show about little baby mermaids, so do my kids, you know, and then you feel guilty, and almost like, my kids are happy and healthy and with me, and these ones aren't. And so there's this weird transition of like leaving the workspace and going into the family space, and you almost disassociate a little bit. So you have to be on top of it mentally. So I'll do this thing where I'll just try to physically connect myself back.
Yeah.
Like, oh, here's a cup.
Right.
Here's my phone. Here's glasses. My coffee is cold. You know, do things to, and it's what anybody going through trauma would have to do. See PTSD, PTSD.
Right.
There is going to be an aspect of that. And that's why a lot of, I think, true crime content creators take long breaks or they stop altogether.
Yeah, I would imagine, because it's very heavy.
Mm-hmm.
So to balance that heaviness out and walking through, which is a difficult job, let's just say that. Are there any big victories? And you must have had some, a few, or you probably wouldn't be able to keep doing this, where after you walk through a lot of difficulty, dug up a lot of information, it was somewhat necessary, and you were able to find truth. Does that give you great satisfaction, especially if you're able to deliver some information to the families that might help them continue to move on?
Yeah, I'm a weird person where I don't stop to enjoy that as often as I should, but when I work with, once again, there's a young man, Praveen Varghese, he was murdered. Carbondale, Illinois. I worked with his mother. Her name's Lovely. She's a lovely person. I brought her to Crime Con to tell her son's story, you know, and then an inundation of people were messaging that police department and being like, what are you doing? Let's move this forward. Things like that, really just harassing the police department, which they needed. And I thought that it was amazing because once again, it's just that connection. Now I have this great connection with Lovely. I follow her on Facebook. She posts pictures of Praveen all the time. I feel like he's with us, almost looking over us, like happy that his mother and this random woman have found each other and have created such a loving relationship. And now all these other people get to meet Lovely. And so it's that's where the true, you're not going to save the world. Even if you get a case adjudicated, even if you get more, it doesn't matter. That person's gone. What matters is that like the community around you lifts you up. And so, you know, like my son is gone, but I can change something in the future, hopefully for somebody else's son. I can make another mother not have to lose her son, or I can help assist in that. And so it's the community swelling around you that makes you feel like, okay, I can do this. I'm not alone. It's not just me. There's tens of thousands of people behind me who also feel this voracious need to raise awareness and help people and hopefully, you know, stop these things from happening in the future, or at least let people know if they do happen, if you're a part of this, we will shine a light on you. You're not going to go under, you know, underground and not be found out. We will find you.
I would say, or guess, you'll tell me if you agree or disagree, that what you're doing is a vocation, probably more than a business, because I don't see how you could pour that much into yourself and your heart and then how hard it is to have it be a business. Would you agree with
that? Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yes. It's a calling.
It's a calling. That's That's what I think it is too.
And who knows why?
Yeah.
So probably something because you're helping a lot of people. Yeah.
In a very difficult, with very difficult information that you're dealing with. But then for the people who are still alive, you are helping them.
I hope so.
I'm in many cases, I'm sure, very much so. In general, to various police departments across the country that you have to like bump up to, are they agreeable or disagreeable to what you're doing?
The majority of the time, they're completely open, agreeable, amazing.
So good.
They view you as a help. But yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Now there's, of course, the random bad apple.
Yeah.
And I happen to be, you know, focused on those because that's where you run into issues. Not only do you have a criminal who did something to a loved one or a family member, but now you have a police department that's not actively trying to help you solve that. So those are the ones I come up with. But in other cases where I just need information, I need police reports, or it's like, hey, can I get like some quick information from you about how it was to be the lead detective on this? I met on a boat in Panama City Beach. I went on a dolphin boat and I met
yesterday,
it was a few days ago, but a detective from, I believe, Tallahassee, who was a lead detective on a case I was familiar with. And so I have his contact information. Wow. And so, you know, there's, for the most part, law enforcement really wants to help.
Yeah.
That's what they're there for. Right. That's what, of course, they want to help. Right. And they want the exposure and they want a lot of people, a lot of police departments have understood, like, okay, crowd solving might be a way. Like, if we've had this case for 10, 15 years, it's not going anywhere, why don't we release maybe the police reports redacted and see what these armchair detectives can do with it? Right. Why not? What's it hurting? And I think most people's family members are on board for that, especially after it's been cold for a while. So for the most part, law enforcement's done amazing.
So I think you are very courageous, and I think you would have to be a courageous person to do everything that you're doing. Were you always courageous?
No.
You weren't? You just became courageous?
I was a little girl who read too much.
So what do you think of that? Are you impressed with like how far you've gone with this?
I don't know if I'm courageous. I don't know.
I think you're courageous.
I won't walk outside at night alone, you know?
So. No, but you're tackling like really tough issues and you have to have a really strong voice to have an opinion, right? A person can't have an opinion about something, especially after you've been researching it, and then be shy about it, right?
No,
so,
I agree.
So there's courage in that. You know that, right?
So for me, I have a very neurodivergent brain. I'm very ADHD. To me, it feels dumb that you can't thoroughly research something and find out truth about it and not speak it. That feels like it doesn't make sense to me, you know. So it doesn't feel brave. It just feels like this is what should happen.
Right.
But I know what you mean. Yeah. Like when I was telling you I'm not Erin Brockovich, I wish I was. I could not. I don't know if I could be that brave in going up against these major chemical companies and seeing these people suffer from these health issues and having to fight day after day, like that would be very difficult. Mm-hmm. And then you're actually in danger. They know what you look like. They know where you are. Right. I have a little bit of anonymity.
Right. Good.
A little bit.
Well, that's good. Okay. So now let's talk about current day with this Redfish Film Festival, where you are featuring the Montauk Project, The Real Stranger Things.
Yes.
Give us the Reader's Digest version of that.
So Montauk is in Long Island. It's right on the tip of New York State, and it was strategically important throughout military history because of that, you know, through the Cold War, through World War II. Yeah. And then there was a military base, and it kind of changed hands, and then it was decommissioned. But the story is, and this is where the Duffer brothers got the idea for Stranger Things, the story is that the CIA had a project that was an offshoot of the Philadelphia Project, where they were trying to figure out how to do like mind control and time travel and things like that. And they were using these psychic children in order to harness their psychic powers and open up this, you know,
vortex.
This vortex. Yeah. And then this monster came through and messed everything up. And then they had to get the monster back in there. But there's people who have come out and said, hey, I was a part of this project. And is it true? I don't know. You're going to have to watch the Montauk Project to find out. But
okay, we'll do.
It's interesting just because of the history of the area. And when you talk to the locals in the area, they do believe it. And the government and law enforcement is still very protective of this area, even though it's been shut down and cordoned off for decades. And it's basically in the middle of a park. It's in this very scenic Montauk New England.
It's beautiful.
It's gorgeous.
It's gorgeous, yeah.
It's almost as beautiful as it is here.
Yeah. So how long did it take you to make this documentary?
So it took a few months to research and write, and then we went to Montauk in the space of, I think, 3 days, did a bunch of drone stuff. There's a beautiful lighthouse that George Washington had built there. So did some drone stuff, camera work, B-roll, had battles with some ticks. And then we got all that and then went and took probably another month or so to put everything together. So overall, probably to 5 months.
Well, I can't wait to watch it.
It's really good.
I'm so glad you're here. I know you have somewhere to go, your busy schedule today. But I want to thank you, and you're very interesting.
Thank you. I
really enjoy talking with you, and I would thank you for everything that you're doing.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
It was lovely to talk to you. I didn't know what to expect coming in. You never do, but...
Well, you don't know, I know, but you're like just...
You have a very open energy, so I appreciate that. An open, curious energy, which makes you a great journalist and reporter.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Glad you're here in Panama City.
Me too. I love it.
Bye-bye, everybody. Have a good day.
Bye.